Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Hello and welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast, explainer episode number 73. My name is Libby Dickinson. I'm the assistant director with the Regulatory Transparency Project. Today we are joined by Catherine Ciano Mahler, who serves as an in-house counsel, and Eric Wang, partner at Vantage Legal. We're excited to welcome these experts for a discussion on the FEC rules concerning campaign funding and the latest changes to the Democratic ticket. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Libby. And thanks so much, Eric, for being here. I've been really curious to talk through this. Obviously, with FEDSOC, we're only discussing the regulatory backgrounds and not giving any kind of political perspectives. And I know we're both here only on our own behalf, not representing any clients, former, current, or future. So, Eric.
Yeah, by the way, along those lines, I'd just like to make clear as well that any views that I express on this podcast are only my views on the law as they're applied to these facts that we're presented with. And they're not meant to be construed as any support or attack for any candidates.
Yep, 100%. So to begin with, want to just hear some of the regulatory background. I know that the FEC is something of a unique agency. So can you give us the background as to what rules apply, how the FEC is supposed to work, and what the traditional regulatory background would be here?
Yeah, so, we start with the statute. I will bypass the Constitution since the Constitution does not speak directly to campaign finance law, even though there are some libertarian absolutists that I know who might argue that the First Amendment doesn't allow for any regulation of campaign finance at all. But there's so much legal water under the bridge now at this point that that position is no longer really practically tenable. So we'll begin with the Federal Election Campaign Act of 1971, and which has been amended various times throughout the years. So that serves as the foundation of modern campaign finance law, and that's what governs the funding of political activity at the federal level in our country, and specifically the funding of campaigns, the political party committees, as well as independent political action committees, including super PACs, as well as even some political nonprofit groups. And then, of course, like any, most other statutes, most other federal statutes, there is an implementing agency that's charged with administering the statute. And in that case, that is the Federal Election Commission, which, like any, most other administrative agencies, has implemented its own rules to interpret the FECA, the statute. It's issued advisory opinions, and it also has enforcement functions, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a little bit. And it also, So that's the Federal Election Commission. And so that's basically the regulatory framework that we're dealing with here.
And what rules apply? Obviously, there have been a lot of campaign dollars already collected by the DNC, by the Biden campaign. What rules apply to those donations that have already been collected and to the funds that are already in place?
Yeah, so, I think the situation is such a great situation because it illustrates so many features of our campaign finance laws. And I keep thinking that if there were a campaign finance class in law school, this would make for a great, final exam question because it illustrates so many features. So first of all, there are contribution limits. That's one of the main pillars of campaign finance laws. There's contribution. One pillar is contribution limits and source prohibitions. And the other pillar is reporting disclosure. So here we're really primarily talking about contribution limits. you know, with respect to any candidate for federal office, right now the limit for any individual donor is to give $3,300 per election with the primary and general elections, counting as separate elections per federal candidate. There are certain PACs that could give up to $5,000 per election. And then with respect to the national party committees, like the Democratic National Committee, each donor, individual donor, can give up to $41,300 per year to the DNC for their main account. And then the DNC has these additional accounts for their building fund, for their administrative expenses, for the Democratic National Convention, as well as for election proceedings, which can raise additional amounts. And so all of the money that the Biden, the former Biden for president campaign has collected, have been collected under these contribution limits, namely the $3,300 per election and $5,000 per election individual and PAC donor limits. And then there's an additional contribution limit that's particularly salient here. And this is sort of a quirky limit in that once a federal candidates committee has collected contributions, there's also limits on how much the federal candidate committee can give to other federal candidates. And that is a hard cap of $2,000 per election from one federal candidate to another. So what the what we saw in the last few days play out, and what's gotten a bit of press attention on the campaign finance side, is that contributions were given to Biden for president by donors with the understanding that they would be used to support Joe Biden's campaign for reelection to the presidency. And now they're being used by a different candidate, Kamala Harris, for her now campaign for the office of the president. And that begs the question, is this money actually subject to this hard $2,000 limit on contributions from one candidate to another? In which case, the fact that she's basically assumed control over what used to be Biden for president and what she's now renamed as Harris for president, there was $96 million almost cash on hand as of the second quarter when they last submitted their FEC report. There was $96 million, it seems at the very least, in cash on hand, plus all of the other non-monetary assets that Biden for president has acquired and also developed through its campaign efforts. And all of these funds, all of these assets now are being controlled by Kamala Harris's campaign for the presidency. And this begs the question, is this essentially actually a $96 million excessive contribution that her now presidential campaign has accepted from the Biden for president campaign? So that's the $96 million question. I mean, forget about the $64,000 question. We've got this $96 million question hanging out there.
It does seem like we're living through an administrative law exam or some sort of a constitutional law exam. Is there precedent here that we're aware of? Are there cases where there has been a similar swap in candidates like this?
So there's not. I mean, this is sort of a sui generis issue, although it's not technically completely sui generis because it's conceivable that sometime down the line, this might happen again, where a presidential candidate withdraws from the race and wants to hand it off to their running mate, or God forbid, if a presidential candidate passes away or is incapacitated during the course of the campaign, they might there might be a desire to have the running mate assume the role at the top of the ticket. But in the past 50 some odd years that the modern campaign finance law has been in existence for, this scenario has never come up before. And the the presidential vice presidential ticket is sort of a unique creature as well, insofar as the only other campaigns that the federal campaign finance law and regulations govern are campaigns for Congress, campaigns for the Senate, campaigns for the House. And those candidates do not run as a ticket, obviously, whereas the presidential and the vice presidential candidates, for the longest time in modern U.S. political history, do run as a ticket. And so because this scenario has never come up before, we don't have any really real precedents or guidance from the FEC or from courts, for that matter, to point to actually, sort of clarify what the right answer is here. But I do think that, reading the statutory text, reading the FEC's implementing regulations, I think there is a strong argument to be made that this, Kamala Harris has done is actually not, clearly permissible. And all of the commentary I've seen from my colleagues in the campaign finance bar who have been quoted in the press on this, I think there is a general consensus that we all agree that there's no clear yes indicating that this is what she's done is permissible. But there have been these theories that I've seen floated that, before Biden dropped out, the what's known as the FEC Form 1, and this is going to be really getting down into the weeds, but this is the statement of organization that each campaign committee files with the FEC. On that FEC Form 1, both Joe Biden and Kamala Harris were listed as candidates, essentially being co-candidates. And this was before, again, this was before Biden withdrew. And so the argument that's been advanced for why this is permissible for Kamala Harris to basically inherit the funds is that basically this was, think of this in a context or an analogy of a marital relationship where the spouses, co-own their property. I think the argument is here they were co-candidates in the campaign committee. The campaign committee was sort of like their marital assets. And because Kamala Harris was listed as a co-candidate, and obviously a candidate is entitled to, maybe this isn't a perfect analogy because in many states, one spouse is only entitled to a half of the marital assets. But there are also, I think, some jurisdictions, and I'm not a property law or family law expert, but I believe that there are also some jurisdictions where one spouse gets an entitlement to all of the marital property. And here, obviously a candidate is entitled to use all of their campaign funds for their own candidacy and for their own campaign. And so the argument that's been advanced is that because Kamala Harris was listed as a co-candidate on the FEC paperwork, she's not subject to this $2,000 limit on contributions from one candidate to another because she was a co-candidate for this campaign committee that was formerly known as Biden for President. Now, I think the counter argument that I would make is that just because people put stuff on FEC filings doesn't necessarily make it so as a matter of law. And we see this all the time. I mean, people, my clients, I see others, put information on FEC filings, whether it's FEC Form 1, FEC Form 2, FEC Form 3, Form 3X, Form 5, Form 9, what have you. They can put whatever information they want on the FEC filings, but it doesn't make it correct as a matter of law. And the FEC often routinely issues requests, demands, enforcement penalties on campaign committees and others filing reports and other documents with the FEC for filing incorrect information. And so just because I don't think that this argument holds water, that just because Kamala Harris was listed as a co-candidate on the FEC filing, that necessarily made her a co-candidate as a matter of law. And there's several, statutory provisions as well as FEC regulatory provisions that I could point to if we want to go further into that.
I'm curious, what's the alternative? Let's say that there's another candidate that were to come up, although it seems like that won't be what happens. But if there were another candidate instead of Kamala who were to take that place, would the scenario be that all donations would have to be returned and redonated? Or what does that look like in terms of the transfer there?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, had Joe Biden not endorsed Kamala Harris as his successor, had Kamala Harris not done this, taken over the funds of Biden for president, the other alternatives primarily would have been, yes, refunds to donors. And then, you know, there would be the hope that those donors would then give to the eventual nominee of the DNC. The other option would have been more straightforward, I think, and that arguably would have been more equitable to other candidates. You know, at one point, there were several serious other candidates that were being floated. You know, I think the more equitable and the more straightforward option would have been to just transfer the remaining funds to the DNC. And under the FEC rules, campaign committees specifically are permitted to transfer an unlimited amount of their funds. So all of the remaining funds of Biden for president could have been transferred over to the DNC. And then presumably the DNC would have used those funds in its wisdom and in the best interests of the party, obviously, to support the party's eventual replacement nominee. And, you know, under the law, there's actually, you know, a provision called the coordinated party expenditure limits, where the DNC could have spent actually $32 million of the $96 million in remaining funds that we're talking about explicitly in coordination with the eventual replacement nominee. Plus, in addition, there are other exceptions under which they could have coordinated, a lot of those dealing with volunteer activities. If they were supported by funds from the party committees, you know, that could have been coordinated with the eventual nominee. Plus, the DNC could have spent an unlimited amount of the remaining funds on what are known as independent expenditures. And those are expenditures that are not coordinated with any candidate. So there's plenty of money that, you know, all of that money basically could have been transferred without any legal question hanging over the, you know, this scenario, and spent to support the eventual Democratic nominee. So I think what this indicates is sort of, and I, you know, I certainly don't blame Kamala Harris for doing this. You know, if I were in her position, I probably would have done the same thing. I think this is smart. This was an effort to quickly secure her place as the replacement nominee and basically shut out all competing candidates. You know, $96 million, having a $96 million head start between now and November, that is, you know, a very daunting disadvantage to other potential candidates. You know, that along with other coalescing of support would quickly shut out any competing candidates.
Makes sense. And in terms of any kinds of questions, the nerdy aspect of wanting to look through these regulatory pieces makes you want to examine what it might look like in a post-Chevron FEC world. I know you've given that some thought. Can you talk through what changes there may be in terms of any kinds of review now that we're in sort of a different administrative environment?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question, particularly for the FEC. So first of all, under Chevron or post-Chevron, the issue that we're dealing with is first primarily an agency interpretation of the statute, right? And right now, you know, I mentioned agency regulations implementing the statute, and the agency regulations here really don't differ all that much from what the statute says. You know, as I sort of alluded to before, I happen to believe that both the statute and the FEC regulations say that, you know, it's true that the presidential and vice presidential nominees share a campaign committee after they're nominated by their political party. That much is clear under the statute and the FEC regulations. Both the statute and the FEC regulations also seem to suggest, strongly suggest, in my view, that prior to their securing their party's nomination, the presidential candidate and the vice presidential candidate do not share a single campaign committee, contrary to what Kamala Harris has, you know, the implicit position that Kamala Harris has taken and the explicit position that many other practitioners have expressed to the press in explaining all this. But other than that, absent an enforcement matter, absent an advisory opinion issued on this, and I don't think that the Harris for President campaign is going to bother asking for an advisory opinion to confirm this post hoc, since they've already gone ahead and done this. But absent an enforcement action or position taken by the FEC, absent an advisory opinion, I don't think we know what the FEC interpretation of the statute as applied to these facts is yet as of this point. So that's the first thing we need to think about when thinking about the post-Chevron world. But when this does, so that then gets us into the enforcement process that's prescribed by the statute. And under the statute, the FEC has sole jurisdiction over civil enforcement of campaign finance laws. And anybody who wants to challenge what Kamala Harris has done is required to first file an administrative complaint with the FEC. And then there's all sorts of procedural issues that are prescribed by the statute. There's also like timeframes that the FEC has to actually abide by. And these are sort of dilatory rather than expeditious timeframes that they have to follow in terms of trying to resolve this issue with a respondent. And then if the FEC fails to take action or if the FEC dismisses the action, then the complainant can sue for judicial review in federal court. And then if the federal court disagrees, you know, at that point, this is where the post-Chevron world comes in. It used to be that, you know, like any other administrative agency, the federal courts under Chevron, you know, if the statute was unclear, as some might argue it is here, the court would have had to defer to the FEC's interpretation of the statute, whereas now it would not after Chevron has been overruled. So, you know, what a federal judge might think of this issue, you know, beats the heck out of me. I happen to, you know, have a sense of how the FEC commissioners might come out on this question. But, you know, in terms of like which judge might be assigned to this and how they might rule on this, you know, I think that's anybody's guess. And, you know, I think after Chevron, this makes it almost a little bit more unpredictable in a sense, because, you know, for at least the past 20 some odd years, the FEC commissioners have been fairly predictable, particularly for those of us who practice in the campaign finance bar and who practice before the agency. You know, we could reliably predict in most instances how enforcement matters would get decided by the FEC. Whereas now you can't really any longer rely on those predictions, because if somebody sues for judicial review, you know, it's in the hands of the judge.
It's an interesting, interesting to think about the various directions that this all goes when it comes to practical implications and what we're all learning live.
Yeah, it's really just a fascinating, I guess, case study of campaign finance law, and it barely scratches the surface of all of the other complex issues and complex scenarios that arise in political activity, not only in campaigns for office, but also in, you know, other forms of political activity, like political giving in just the normal course, as well as even issue advocacy activities that mention federal elected officials and candidates. So it's a really complex regulatory structure, and you know, we're seeing, you know, sort of the tip of that iceberg with this question, which is a significant question.
Do you think that we'll see a change coming from this? There's been sort of waxing and waning of PACs, parties, and the other recipients of donor dollars. Do you anticipate this changing the way that individuals tend to give based on the party being potentially the one who's more in charge of where the process lands?
Yeah, honestly, I have no idea how this particular example or instance will change donor behavior. Like I said, I think it's so sui generis that I don't think most donors are going to have this, be concerned about the scenario and change their strategy of giving, particularly not at the small donor level. And even at the large donor level, I don't think that this is likely going to, affect their political giving strategy. But I do think that perhaps, in the next round of amendments to the campaign finance laws, perhaps Congress might want to more specifically address this issue so that, it's a little bit clearer. Because I do think it's clear that, there are various mentions of the vice president and the presidential ticket in the statute. And again, most of those provisions address post-nomination. And so perhaps they might want to more clearly address the pre-nomination side and what happens with, if the scenario were to arise again.
Yeah, really, really interesting. Well, thank you so much for chatting through this. This has been really fascinating to learn about, and we're all kind of watching as this unfolds. So thank you for the time and for the discussion.
Hey, it's been my pleasure. And thank you, Kat. And thank you to the Federalist Society for hosting us.
Yeah, thank you both so much. That was a great discussion. And if you're interested in learning more about the Regulatory Transparency Project's programming, you can head on over to rtp.fedsoc.org for more information. Thank you.
On behalf of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.